With the more neutral event that I picked, the experience was a little bit different, primarily because it's something that comes and goes so fast. You know, switching between DOS and Windows is something that takes a split second. So it took a long time before. The first time I recognized anything about this exercise, it was to remember, wow, I've switched between DOS and Windows a lot, and I haven't remembered to do it. I haven't remembered to check in. And I'm telling you this because this is the way it tends to go for people. So I took that as just a recognition, say, oh, I've forgotten these past few times, not to give it up, but to rededicate myself to try again. So over the course of a period of time, I don't even remember how long it took, but it worked its way back. So initially, you know, it had been a long time. You know, probably a day would go by before maybe I'd get home from at work and remember, oh, I didn't remember at all that day. And then the next day, maybe I would remember, you know, a few minutes after the thing had happened. You know, a few minutes after I'd switched between DOS and Windows, it would go, oh, it just happened a few minutes ago, and I didn't remember. That's the next step. It's the mindfulness is getting a little closer to the event. So you can take heart at this kind of thing. You know, it's not a failure. It's actually the way that this unfolds. And then, you know, it happened that I remembered right after the experience of switching between DOS and Windows. Just, oh, it just happened. It just happened. And then at some point I was aware of it just as it would happen. And it became a kind of a coming back, a regular coming back over and over and over again in my day. And then, you know, over a period of time, you kind of have to rededicate yourself to that commitment to do it, because once you've gotten to that place where it works, you kind of get lazy. You know, you think, oh, I've got it now, I've figured it out, and it works for a while, and then because you're not dedicating your energy to it, it drifts off again. So you kind of need to bring yourself back. So that's the kind of pattern that these things take if you pick some kinds of projects in your daily life. And I'd really encourage you to try this, to try picking one or two things. There's so many things you can choose. A couple of the things I've chosen over my time is the act of standing. That's one thing, just the physical act of standing. That happens quite a bit during our day. We're sitting and we stand up. So just noticing the action of standing. Check-in. It's a very simple kind of check-in, simply, what's the mood? What's the state of mind? How's the body? Is the body tense? Is it relaxed? Is the mind projecting forward to the place we're going? Is the mind hanging back to what we're doing? What's going on in a very simple way? You don't have to do a lot of detailed analysis, but just see if you can know in this moment, how am I feeling? A kind of a bare, basic thing to check in is my state of mind pleasant or unpleasant? Is my state of body pleasant or unpleasant? Very, very simple. Just what's happening in this moment. So standing up is one option. One of my favorites, I think it came up last week, was Thich Nhat Hanh's suggestion of waiting 3 rings for the telephone. And I really loved doing this practice. I would listen to the rings of the telephone and breathe, and then pick up the phone and answer the phone. And it was just a very nice way to actually be very relaxed and present when I ended up on the phone talking to someone, instead of being resentful that somebody was pulling me away from my work. I could use it as a kind of a joyful reminder to, oh, I get to spend a few breaths meditating and just relaxing here. Just, it's kind of a bell to help me remember to relax and be present. One of my favorite processes also that I discovered at some point was the whole process of going to the bathroom. I used that whole process as a time to pay attention. It takes, I don't know, 3-4 minutes to do that. So, you know, the act of recognizing that I needed to do that, that's when it began. And then the process of standing, getting the key. I was in an office where I had to get a key for the restroom, and then going, unlocking the door. All of the activity in the restroom, washing my hands, coming out, putting the key back, the whole process, just noticing what was happening. That whole process At the end of that time, I really felt like I'd had a little mini vacation. It was quite a lovely break from the kind of propelled movement of the mind that kind of happens in our day, that kind of spins forward and spins out. And to just take these 3 or 4 minutes, 4 or 5 times a day, however often you have to go, to just come back and see what it's like to just pay attention to that activity. Another good thing to experiment with is being mindful of any chore. Chores are great places to pay attention because we have to do our chores. And often we spend our time resenting the fact that we have to do our chores. So why not just pay attention and use it as something productive when we think, well, this is a waste of time. Why do I have to be doing this thing? Well, use it for mindfulness. Notice what the sensations are. Notice the mood, the reactivity, the resistance to paying attention, the resistance to doing the chore at all. Just notice what happens. Chores are great because they often don't take much more than, you know, load the dishwasher, unload the dishwasher. Probably takes 4 or 5 minutes to do that. Just use those 4 or 5 minutes to be present. And again, I just suggest you pick one or two of these things, not all of them. See what happens as you try. I mean, if you picked unloading the dishwasher, it may be 3 days before you remember. So just know that that process happens that I described before. There's a number of things you can pay attention with the chores. And I found on retreat, there's a period of time in the day that we do a work meditation to participate in the running of the retreat. So every day for about 45 minutes, everyone on the retreat participates in some activity, chopping vegetables, cleaning the bathroom, vacuuming, sweeping, something like that. And so over the course of my years of doing long retreat, I've done a number of these jobs. And they've been a really wonderful place for me to learn and to understand what it means to be present in daily life. It's a great bridge in the retreat practice to our daily life practice. So in the chopping vegetables, you know, there's the whole experience of standing, there's the sensation of the knife in the hand on the vegetable, and I kind of got interested in knowing, how do I know that the knife is going through the vegetable? I mean, I'm not the knife, and I'm not right there. It's all in the vibration of the fingers on this hand that know that the knife has cut in. It's the pressure, the extra pressure you have to put on the knife, the sense of pushing. So the sensations are in our body that let us know these things. And I was completely oblivious to many of these sensations until I started paying attention. Vacuuming. One time I was doing the vacuuming job at a retreat and I noticed I was kind of scrubbing the floor with the vacuum. And I realized, well, the vacuum does the work, you know. I don't really have to scrub the floor. All I have to do is just gently push it and pull it. And that changed my whole relationship to vacuuming, to not feel like I had to scrub the floor while I was vacuuming. So there's a lot of things that we can bring our attention to, the intensity with which we work, the physical bodily sensations, hearing. A lot of different things come into play, all the seeing, all the changing. It's a great place to work with our seeing practice. So bringing our attention into our physical activities in our day. It's really great to pick some kind of physical activity as one of the projects because it helps to get us to remember to wake up out of the course of our own activity. So as opposed to setting a bell to remember to have you pay attention, just a regular bell. That can be a good thing, to set a bell regularly throughout the day, but it's also very powerful to have some action that you do be the trigger for the mindfulness, because it helps to really integrate the waking up into our own activity. It becomes more of a part and parcel of our experience to begin to bring our mindfulness into the activity because of the activity itself. Another good thing to work with, and I chose myself, something that was up for me. So the anger, when I first started the practice, was what was really, that was the whole motivation for my coming to practice, the out-of-control nature of my mind. So choosing that as a as a place to bring my attention. So if there's something like that, it can be very challenging. It took me years to work with this anger. It was something I came back to over and over and over again, the process of working with this anger. But it was extremely productive, and eventually it did wind itself out. So it can be very powerful to bring your attention to something like that, whether it's fear or anger or greed, whatever it is that you find. Impatience was one I paid attention to for a while. I found impatience to be really up for me for a period of time. So I just said, well, I'll just pay attention when impatience arises. And I noticed it everywhere. I mean, it was arising all over the place. It arose when I brushed my teeth because I felt like, well, this is a waste of time. You know, I've got better things to do than brush my teeth. Impatient to get it over with because it seemed like such a trivial, meaningless thing to brush my teeth. It was just rampant throughout my day. So I really began to see how much of a pattern and habit the impatience was in my mind. And I had to laugh one day because I was walking down the street and I noticed the impatience arise in my mind. And the very next moment was, I've been looking at this impatience for 2 months now. There it was again. Yeah, impatience on top of impatience. So I just had to laugh at that point because I had seen it. So another way I've helped myself to pay attention in my day is to put little notes around my house, reminding me to wake up. So there's a list that the Buddha has, or actually I guess it's more in the commentaries, the list of the perfections of the mind. There are the qualities that we really cultivate and develop as we develop this practice and develop our mindfulness. So there are qualities like generosity, loving kindness, wisdom, patience, equanimity, compassion actually isn't in the list, but there are those kinds of qualities. So I put little notes around my house. I put patience by the bathroom sink because I had noticed the consistency of the mind becoming impatient while brushing my teeth. Truthfulness went on the telephone. Wisdom went on the refrigerator. Equanimity went on the computer. Giving went on the front door to help remind me to be generous as I walked out the door. So I just put little notes around my house like that. So those are just some thoughts or some suggestions about bringing the practice into our day. So now I'd like to talk for a few minutes about intention. And this was what I had suggested that you work with over the week with this exercise of not setting the clock to get up. But I'm curious, what was it like for you when I suggested that you not move? You actually looked pretty still, most of you, at that point, so I don't know that it had a big effect, but I'm curious what happened for you. Anybody willing to? What happened when I suggested that you not move, when you take a resolve of stillness during the guided meditation? Was there any kind of a... Did you notice a point where you wanted to move? Go ahead.
I sometimes get a problem when I'm meditating where I get itches on my face, and as soon as that happened, I had like three of them.
Were you able to watch the wanting, or did you go ahead and move?
No, I managed not to, but it was very aggravating.
Yes. So what did you notice? What kind of experiences did you notice in that?
Just the tension between, it's quite uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were fighting it, and I tried to concentrate on what the sensation was, and sometimes it would disappear, but then another one would come.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was more a feeling of exasperation than anything else.
Uh-huh. That's the mind reacting to the whole thing. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, itches are a great place. I actually love watching itches because, nobody's ever died of an itch as far as I know. So, you can really, pay attention to the whole process of the itching, just the arising of that sensation, the intensity of it, the whole urge of the body. You just feel like this compelling move to move to itch that, to move to scratch the itch. So this is a point of noticing that the sensation of the body has motivated an action, has motivated the desire for an action. So the sensation has motivated the desire for the action. And if we actually move, then we've got the desire for the action motivating the action. So we've gone from the body to the mind. So the body has created some kind of a sensation, and it's created this wanting. So the wanting is there in the mind. The wanting generates a further impulse to move. So that is another thing in the mind, and that impulse to move then generates the movement of the body. So it's just a chain of cause and effect happening in the mind. And when we can start to see that, we begin to unwind the whole idea of somebody being here doing things. It really we start to witness that the whole process, the whole mind-body continuum, is really just a flow, a continuing process of change, of body sensations motivating mind and mind motivating body. It really is just a flow. So just by watching an itch, we can see this kind of thing. It can take some time because we do get that exasperation and we get kind of attached to wanting to get rid of the exasperation by scratching the itch. But it's a great place to observe. Anybody else see anything? Yeah.
But I was breathing more than I really needed to, and then I could, I was thinking about the fact that was ridiculous.
Yeah, I wondered whether anybody would comment about the breathing, because it does move the body. I mean, it's fine to let the breathing move the body, and in fact, it can be a great way to let the body relax, to notice the kind of gentle movement that the breathing itself creates. So it can be a really good place to help the body relax. Anyone else have any? Yeah.
This is not necessarily related to not moving, but I notice that when I really get my mind to settle down, that usually when that happens, that I start to fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I'm sitting up. And almost when I fall asleep, my mind starts to get more active. Does that make sense? Where it starts to chatter more, and then I'll...
Well, is it kind of like dreamlike images, or I mean, is it a different quality?
No, I'm thinking about what's going on in my day. But
oh,
like
okay.
My body is falling asleep, and then I'll I think because I'm sitting up, I'll start to lean forward, and then that will wake me up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty common when we relax that the mind will start to go to sleep. I mean, a lot of us are sleep deprived, so. You know, when we get our body into a state of relaxation and our eyes are closed, the mind says, "Oh, it's time to go to sleep." You know, so we do end up going in that place. It can just happen for some time. And also, it is kind of common to notice that the mind will go into a kind of a dreamlike state sometimes when you do that, or it can go into a reverie of what's been happening through the day. It can just kind of begin to wander, but you're noticing it, so you're seeing that happening. So I think it sounds fine. And it just partly, when something like that happens, you can do a couple of things. One thing you could try is to breathe a little more deeply to bring a little more energy into the body. That can help because we do get kind of relaxed. Or at the evening, at this time of day, it's really common for people to get sleepy. I mean, we've just had a whole day of busyness, and we stop for a few moments. It's like, oh yeah, this feels good. I'm going to sleep. So it can help to vary the time when you actually meditate. So if you find you're more alert in the morning, that may happen to you less in the morning. So you can just experiment with it, and don't be concerned about it. It's something that we all experience in the process of meditating, that we do end up getting sleepy. You can notice what it feels like to get sleepy. You can also notice the sensations of sleepiness in your body. You may notice some very pleasant sensations in your body. And bringing your attention there, I found in that kind of a situation, it can help to energize the mind because it likes paying attention to something pleasant. So you can bring your attention into the kind of weight and heaviness in the body and the fullness. There's some very, very pleasant sensations that happen. And that's another place to bring the attention when you get sleepy. So I'll talk for a few moments about intention itself. Intention is a subtle shift of mind that happens, that precedes any act of body, speech, or mind. We can know we're going to move before we move. We can know we're going to speak before we speak. And we can actually know we're going to think before we think. We can notice that movement of mind to intend to think. We can notice we're heading in the direction of an emotion before the emotion has actually appeared, as I described in my example of the apple and the anger. I recognized the movement of the mind towards anger before the anger was actually there. So these are all the intentions of the mind, the knowing we're going to do something before we do something. In and of itself, intention is a pretty neutral event. It's simply an energetic impulse that propels us into action. It's a sense of knowing what something's going to happen before it happens. Sometimes teachers call it the about-to moment. So you know or you recognize something is about to happen before it happens. But accompanying that relatively neutral moment of about to, that impulse to move, is a motivation. It's the reason why we're going to move, the reason why we're going to act. We can be motivated by many, many things. We can be motivated by generosity, by loving kindness, by compassion, by greed, by aversion, by frustration, by desire. Many, many things will motivate us. And in that moment, before we act, if we can catch the moment right before we've acted, we have a chance to see what our motivation is for acting in that moment. So one of the most powerful places to pay attention to this is in the area of speech. Most of us have had the experience of wishing we hadn't said something to someone. And through this practice of pausing, one way to practice with speech is to make a practice for some period of time, pausing before you speak. And it can be helpful to do this with somebody who knows that you're doing it, so it doesn't feel too awkward at first. So, you know, do it with a friend who perhaps is also trying it. You could sit down together and try to have a conversation where you pause for a moment before you speak. So that act of pausing itself is very powerful and is very difficult. It's very difficult to do this. I find, and I have corroboration from a number of teachers, that paying attention to speech and being mindful of speech is one of the most difficult places to bring mindfulness. It's very, very challenging. But being able to at least know you're going to speak before you speak gives you a little inroad into this practice. So in that place of pausing before you speak, you've got a chance to, first of all, know that you're going to speak. And second of all, you might know what you're going to say before you say it. Probably you will if you've paused before you speak. You'll know what you're going to say before you say it. Most of the time we speak, words just tumble out of our mouth and we don't really know what we're going to say. We often don't even know we're going to speak. We just find ourselves speaking. And less often do we even stop to consider the impact of what we're going to say on the person we're talking to. So this moment of pausing before we speak gives us an opportunity to notice what we're going to say. We have a chance to potentially notice the motivation behind what we're saying and have hopefully a chance to choose. Do I want to say this thing? If I'm motivated out of frustration or anger or hatred, perhaps it's not such a good idea to say this thing in this moment. If I'm motivated out of compassion or generosity, then maybe it's a good thing to say. But still, noticing and thinking about potentially the impact of what you're going to say. So getting in touch with our motivations can be eye-opening and it can be humbling. as we start to do this, we really begin to see how much we're motivated by greed and aversion, those two forces operating in us, and delusion as well. At one point, I was practicing in a monastery, and I was really paying attention to this intention in my walking meditation. Every time I came to the end of the path, I would pay attention to the intention to turn around. And I would notice, I would be standing there and waiting and noticing that the intention to turn was almost always accompanied by something like boredom or frustration or aversion, just like, I'm tired of standing here, or I'm so bored, I just got to keep going, or something. There's something, some kind of spin on simply turning around. It was quite eye-opening. At one point, I went to my teacher. I kind of got stuck, because what a part of the training in the monastery is to hopefully not act on unwholesome motivations. We try to refrain from acting when we see we're motivated out of aversion or greed. And I went to my teacher and I said, every time I'm standing at the end of my walking path and I wait for the intention to turn, and I notice that the intention to turn is motivated by some greed or aversion. And he said, note standing 5 times and then turn. So just come up with some very, standard way to do it so that I didn't have to be motivated by, because what I was doing was standing there and waiting for the intention to arise to turn. And when it arose, something else was going on in my mind. And that often happens with movement. We often are motivated to move out of a desire or some aversion to pain, or some a desire to get something yummy to eat. Something will motivate us. It can be that we're motivated out of some very wholesome things. We can be motivated simply out of a very basic need, a need to empty our bladder, a need to get some food because we're hungry. Those can also be accompanied by unwholesome motivations or wholesome motivations. Our motivations, we'll begin to see as we explore this, can be really mixed. There'll be a whole mixture of things that come together. When we say something to someone, it's got a component of wanting to say something to help them, and it's got a component of wanting to make ourselves look good. You know, kind of those two things. You know, we can have these mixed motivations. This practice of paying attention to our motivations isn't particularly to judge what the motivations are, but to really begin to witness how we're motivated, to begin to witness what moves us. And as we do this practice, as we witness our motivations, and if we keep paying attention, we'll witness the consequences of our actions, the consequences of acting out of a particular motivation. We'll get to experience in our own mind and body whether that was a beneficial thing to do or not. So the process of paying attention to our actions, to our intentions, to our motivations, I look at it as kind of a self-teaching process. We don't have to do much with it other than observe what's happening. We observe anger arising. We observe the speech that arises out of it. We observe the hurt that causes somebody. We observe the pain that it causes us. We feel all of these things. We act out of generosity. We observe the good feeling of wanting to give. We observe the joy in somebody else for accepting that gift. We observe the joy in ourselves for having seen them be joyful. We learn how these things follow one on another. We begin to train ourselves in the patterns of cause and effect through paying attention. And this process of simply paying attention to these patterns begins to train the mind kind of almost by itself. In this experience I talked about last week, about the apple and the anger, noticing the thought about this person and noticing the kind of inclination or movement in the mind towards anger. I had spent months at that point. I had spent months paying attention to what it felt like to be angry, really deeply experiencing how unpleasant it was and how painful, physically painful it was, burning me up inside. I noticed that I had this idea that somehow anger was supposed to hurt the person that I was angry with. this was clearly not happening in this case because the person I was angry with was 7,000 miles away. I was in an island in the middle of the South Pacific and he was in California. So there was no way this anger was going to go across the ocean and hurt him. It was burning me up. I had felt that so clearly over these months. And when the mind saw the movement, the actual movement to go towards anger, it just said, I don't think so. I know what that feels like. The mind just let go of it all by itself. I didn't have to choose to refrain from having the anger arise. It just happened. So as we pay attention like this to the motivations, to the intentions, to the consequences of our actions, the mind really trains itself. It can train itself. So in terms of paying attention to our motivation and our beginning to hopefully get a chance to choose, do we want to act on this motivation or not? We have to take care that we don't become attached to particular consequences happening as a result of our action. So we may tend to notice that if we act out of generosity, that we get a good response from people, that we feel good about it. But we cannot count on that. We can't count on the how our actions fit into the whole web of cause and effect in the world. The web of karma, the web of cause and effect is vast. There's no way that we can know how a